operations. In the wake of 9/11, the Bush administration's mantra became that no one could have imagined such an attack before it took place.
I don't think anybody could have predicted that these people would take an airplane and slam it into the World Trade Center, take another one and slam it into the Pentagon, that they would try to use an airplane as a missile, a hijacked airplane as a missile.
First, I must say, I knew of no intelligence during the 6+ months leading up to September 11th that indicated terrorists would hijack commercial airliners, use them as missiles to fly into the Pentagon or the World Trade Center towers.
Nobody in our government, at least, and I don't think the prior government, that could envision flying airplanes into buildings on such a massive scale.
But like everything else the Bush administration told the public about 9/11, this too was a lie. Not only had government officials envisioned flying airplanes into buildings or using an airplane as a missile, but multiple agencies trained for just such an event prior to 9/11. In fact, as General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 2001 to 2005, went on to tell the 9/11 Commission, this precise scenario of a hijacked jet being flown into a high-value target was drilled by NORAD not once or twice, but 5 separate times in the run-up to September 11th. On November 6, 1999, they simulated an event in which terrorists hijacked a passenger jet flying out of JFK with the intention of crashing it into the United Nations building in New York. On June 5, 2000, they simulated 2 hijackings, one in which the terrorists intended to fly the plane into the Statue of Liberty, and the other in which the intended target was the White House. An October 16, 2000 NORAD drill saw a hijacker once again targeting the UN building, as did a nearly identical exercise on October 23rd of that year. One of NORAD's pre-9/11 hijack drills even saw the World Trade Center itself become the intended target. Other exercises involved not just hijacked jets as weapons, but tested NORAD's response to simultaneous hijackings being used in a coordinated attack on American airspace.
Welcome to the Truth Over Comfort show. Today's returning guest is James Corbett of The Corbett Report. He's here today to talk about 9/11 in the run-up to the anniversary of 9/11, or whenever this recording comes out, it may be closer after the time. James has done a series of documentaries over the years on the subject, from 9/11 war games to trillions to 9/11 whistleblowers to his recent-ish documentary series on the history of Al-Qaeda and kind of false flag attacks around that. It's great to have you here, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on.
Just for full disclosure, I guess, before the interview, on myself. So I don't really come with a consolidated view yet. I've watched lots of your documentaries. I've heard some of the people more in the anti-war side who don't really step into the 9/11 bit. I don't really have a consolidated view. When I was watching lots of the 9/11 stuff, I'm like, definitely, you know, suspicious, things like that. But I don't ultimately have a consolidated view. And part of that is I just want to do kind of more research. So I'm at this fairly. I mean, I'm deeply kind of suspicious, and whatever you think about 9/11, the official story is obviously a lie, in that they did lie many times, as you played in your documentaries, where they said they couldn't have imagined anything like this could have happened. There's clearly, as we get to with the war games, complete lies, but that could just be them covering their own ass, you could say. So I just wanted to say that I'm going to try and be fair, but I do come with a deep suspicion, which is why obviously I'm having you on in the first place. Just before we get going, I'm not going to make you do it, but I know you said you would, but I know you didn't come at 9/11 from the very first minute as a 9/11 truther, or whatever you want to call it. It took, you know, about, I think you said about the 5th anniversary, something like that, where you started using the internet in Japan and seeing all these documentaries and things like that that made you suspicious and look into it. I think people, if they want to see that, they'll hear that in lots of your other interviews. So you didn't come at it from the first point as that, but I haven't really heard you give your view, and I know some of it is always speculation, So what is your overall view of 9/11? You know, kind of, there's different theories on, you know, did they, certain figures allow it to happen? Did the, you know, did George Bush himself sign off on it? You know, did certain groups utilize it, or did they actually create the situation, facilitate? You know, what is your general view of 9/11? What happened? And I guess the actual people involved, because as much as people would pin it on George Bush, it would be quite unlikely George Bush was actually involved at all. So just let me know kind of your outline thoughts, and then we can get to the evidence of what brought you to that point.
Sure. Well, yes, first I can say I am sympathetic to the point of view of people who perhaps suspect that there may be something wrong with the official story, but haven't looked into it enough to really be able to articulate that, because I was in that position when I started. In fact, before I started into what became the corporate report, I was even in a state of even profounder ignorance, having actually read, unlike most people, I actually read the 9/11 Commission report from cover to cover. So this is the edition of the 9/11 Commission report that I purchased here in Japan back in 2005, I believe, if my memory serves, 2004, 2005, whenever it came out. Because I remember at the time, the Japan Times would publish a section from the Los Angeles Times as part of its weekend special. And they had there was a feature that they wrote about the 9/11 Commission report. And it was this glowing review of this report, saying it's so interesting and it's not like a government document. It actually reads like an action tale and blah, blah, blah. And so I got caught up in that. Oh, really? Okay. This is the story of 9/11. So I read it cover to cover. And at the time thought, well, there you go. There's the story. That's what happened. And obviously, I say obviously, perhaps it's not obvious, but I was very much against the policies of the Bush administration and the war in Iraq and all of that. But I thought, well, they're using this obviously as a justification, but I had no questions or qualms about the story that was portrayed in here. Well, once I started to actually look into this story, I discovered, oh, this is a tissue of lies front to back. And one of the first things we have to know about the 9/11 Commission report and the information that was compiled by the 9/11 commissioners is that this is torture testimony extracted through torture that would not be permissible in any court of law worthy of the name, which is exactly why we have seen the kangaroo court military commission nonsense going on in Guantanamo for the past 20 years and the crazy developments on that front in recent times. It's because, yes, they tortured people to get what they wanted to hear out of various people, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others, that we know demonstrably is lies. For example, KSM having confessed to plotting to bomb buildings that didn't even exist at the time that he was rounded up originally. So we know that this is not reliable, but that gets swept under the rug. Yes, there was a judge who even ordered the CIA to keep the videotapes that they had of these torture interrogations that were being used. The CIA deliberately deleted them, deliberately against court orders, went and deleted them. So we'll never get to see what this was actually based on. But anyway, that gives a sense of why we should be deeply skeptical of the information that purports to come from here. Having said that, and having gone on that rant, I forget what your initial question actually was.
My question was just your general view of what happened.
Yes.
And if you right. want, before you say that, if you want to just tell people the official story, as you know, everyone kind of knows it, but you know, as time goes on, people just, you know, Twin Towers.
Yeah, of course. And we have to keep in mind, which is weird for me, but I have to keep this consciously in mind, there are people in this audience who probably were not born when these events were taking place, or were just children or babies even. So, yes, maybe they don't know the details of this story. It's been hardwired into my brain because I was coming of age when all of this took place. So I was very much steeped in the propaganda as it was taking place. But one of the there were a couple of images that were absolutely emblazoned in the minds of anyone who was watching, certainly the American media, which I was watching as a Canadian. We get, of course, a lot of secondhand American media. The images that were absolutely burnt into your mind were, of course, the plane striking, the buildings coming down, and the 19 men. And they would always show the FBI picture lineup, which even that, there's some interesting questions about that picture lineup and the actual identities of some of those people, even to this day. And I suppose if I do another 9/11 documentary in the future, it might be about the identification of those people, what it tells us, the people that were mistakenly confused for other people, etc. There's more to say about that. But essentially, yes, 19 men armed with box cutters managed to overpower the crews and the pilots of four separate flights, hijacking those flights, flying them wildly off course for an hour and a half, in some cases, without a single fighter interceptor in the entire eastern seaboard of the United States managing to intercept them, which to the average person, the average civilian who knows nothing about NORAD or the way it works, maybe that sounds, well, I don't know, maybe that's how it works. But I assure you that is not how it would work on any normal day of aviation. It is how it worked on 9/11/2001, which was not a normal day of aviation. And if people want more details of that, as you say, I did an entire documentary on 9/11 war games, talking about the multiple dozens of war games, simulations, live fly exercises, drills, and other such things that were demonstrably affecting the air defenses that day. But anyway, so the story goes, they managed to fly these planes wildly off course, and there was a shoot down order given, which was confirmed to the 9/11 Commission in closed door testimony of Bush and Cheney. Yes, there was that shoot down order for Flight 93, the final plane to come down, but thankfully no one had to make that decision because it just came down of its own accord. The whole let's roll story, as the passengers supposedly took over the cockpit and brought the plane down. So that is the story. And of course, we saw the planes. We saw planes hitting buildings like the World Trade Center 1 and 2. And we saw the Pentagon. And some people, if they were watching and paying special close attention at about 5:30 p.m. on 9/11/2001, might have seen WTC-7, the Salomon Brothers building, coming down despite not having been hit by a plane. And of course, we saw the propaganda machine kick into overdrive as almost immediately, as I demonstrated, in fact, in probably the Al-Qaeda documentary, probably a couple of the documentaries. I played the clip from literally seconds after the second plane strike when on Fox News, I can't remember the name of the host, but he immediately identified this as probably the work of Osama bin Laden. And from that point on, that became the narrative. And by the end of the day, essentially, the entire case had been solved by the media. If you believe people, the talking heads on the media, it was Osama bin Laden, it was Osama bin Laden. And lo and behold, after a bit of investigation and a bit of look-see and rumors and innuendo, it turned out, yes, it was Osama bin Laden who had directed the attack. And the bigger story that was revealed through the torture testimony, it came from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, something called the Plains Operation in the mid-1990s. It morphed out of this Bojinka plot to hijack aircraft and blow them up over the Pacific. But then eventually that shifted into this operation to use planes as missiles. And there were 19 men that were recruited for this operation, et cetera, et cetera. And Osama bin Laden was hiding in Afghanistan, being protected by the Taliban. So we got to go in and bombs blazing, go and wipe out the Taliban. But that immediately became, well, now we have to get Saddam in Iraq for some reason. Don't think about it too hard. Something about Saddam and 9/11. We'll never quite say what, but just think of those two things together in your mind. And of course, it became the Iraq War almost immediately. Interestingly enough, the exact point at which they started flipping that script and going from, well, the Taliban, Afghanistan, that's yesterday's news, now we're heading to Iraq, was the exact point at which Osama bin Laden and his band of merry men were holed up in the caves of Tora Bora, surrounded on all sides with U.S. Special Forces literally there waiting for orders, requesting to go in and finish the job, and being told no. And then Osama bin Laden escaped across the border and managed to avoid the biggest dragnet in the history of the world for 10 years. An amazing story on a number of levels. And if you can listen to all of that and not have any questions, then you are a particularly incurious human being.
Yeah, so all those events bring a lot of questions, and Tora Bora is a good example there of Osama bin Laden getting away to the Pakistani border. Very strange events. People kind of involved in that have come out and said it was just odd that we wouldn't get the order, all this thing. It's always put down to government incompetence. They did, I think it was 2009, they did an inquiry. John Kerry was involved with Tora Bora debacle. As for 9/11, questions there with Tower 7. Didn't get hit, but apparently the jet fuel melted the steel structure, which brought it down like a controlled demolition. Then you have the Pentagon, which to fly a plane into the Pentagon, if you look at the videos, not as in the real ones, as in a simulated one, I'll tell why. Looks like an extremely, extremely, extremely hard maneuver to pull off how they did that. And why I said simulated is because the only videos we've got, I think, of a petrol garage is just see nothing, see something, and then you see an explosion and not really much else. And after, what is it, over, you know, 20, 23 years coming up to, that's all we've got, the footage, which is just incredible. And then, as you said, in Pennsylvania, you know, some of the theories of more, I guess, the less conspiratorial side would be that they did shoot it down because there was bits of the plane found miles away. And when you look at the video of where the plane is, it just looks like a homeless bin fire. You're like, where is it? There's just this crater with a few things. It's like, it looks like someone might have been camping. You know, where is the plane? You mentioned before the War Games, and that, I think that was the first documentary I watched of yours, and that was quite incredible to watch. I think the NORAD tapes, it was called, came out, where if you could just lay out kind of the story of the War Games there, and the reason, obviously, no fighter jets were scrambled to, you know, get these planes and all the different War Games going on before, and the actual lies of the administration saying, no administration could have thought this. NARS, not the previous one, but there was War Games specifically to do with buildings around New York and Washington getting hit by planes, explosions, specifically ones with Osama bin Laden with his face on the document. So if you could just outline that story, because I think it's quite an incredible one, even if you maybe again don't lean towards what this means they did it, it just shows the lies of the story at least.
Yes. So if people want the full details on this, please go to CorbettReport.com/911WarGames, where you can watch, listen to, or read the entire documentary. And it has all of, not only what I say about it, but more importantly, the links to all of the information. And I won't be able to remember every detail off the top of my head. But for example, you mentioned in passing the cover of what I believe was Amalgam Virgo 01, which came out, I believe, in July of 2001, which was a planning document for a exercise that was being planned, I believe, at the NORAD level, that, as you say, featured Osama bin Laden's face on the cover. And if memory serves, also included the World Trade Center in crosshairs on the same cover, if I'm remembering that correctly. At any rate, that was one of the literally, as I say, dozens of exercises, drills, simulations, and other things that were being conducted in or around 9/11/2001. Perhaps the most well-known of which was Vigilant Guardian, which was taking place throughout the week of September 11th. That was a NORAD exercise that did include live fly exercises, which, again, for people who don't know about this, is crazy, but apparently on actual real live flights, they conduct simulated experimental exercises of various situations that they and drills and hijackings, etc. We don't know all of the details specifically of what they were conducting that day, but we do know from the NORAD tapes that have been released and have been well known about for the better part of two decades now. We do know that the part of what was going on 9/11/2001 was the injection of fake radar blips onto NORAD screens as part of this exercise, the simulation of simulated hijackings and attacks that they were practicing for that week. They were actually inserting fake radar blips, which, according to the official story, that was no problem, because at the point at which they realized there was a real attack going on while they were simulating this attack, they simply gave an order and all of those fake radar blips disappeared and they went on with business as usual. In fact, it even made them better at responding because they were already in the middle of preparing to respond to a simulated. So now they've got real hijackings. Okay, we're ready for it. Or at least that's what they want to say, which still, if that is true, then it just goes to show the absolute glaring, utter incompetence of NORAD and its supposed air defenses. Because, of course, what did they do? They scrambled jets, in the wrong direction, first of all, sending them out over the Atlantic Ocean before coming back to New York, at which point, of course, the whatever happened at World Trade Center 1 and 2 was already done, and there was no use for them there. And also, they weren't able to apparently intercept 93 on its long trajectory in towards Washington. They knew it was coming for at least half an hour in advance. We have the, for example, testimony of Norman Mineta, which, again, has huge question marks about it. But according to him, there was he was in the POC, the P-E-O-C, the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, in the guts basement hiding bunker of the White House, along with Vice President Cheney and other people in the chain of command, who he testified. This is the transportation minister in the United States at that time, the secretary. And he testified that President Cheney had a military aide who was coming in to brief him in the time that 93 was supposedly coming in every few minutes or so. Oh, it's 30 minutes out. It's 20 minutes out. It's 10 minutes out. Do the orders still stand? At which point he says, Cheney turned to him and barked roughly, did you hear anything to the contrary? Of course, the orders still stand. And the next thing we know, the plane supposedly, again, according to the official story, well, then the plane ended up in the Pentagon. So what was the order? And who was this person? Well, actually, that aide has been identified, his role, etc. I've talked about that before. I won't have the name off the top of my head, but people can look into my research for that. But essentially, was it a stand-down order or a shoot-down order? Well, people can use their own judgment on what may or may not have taken place with regard to that. But more importantly, I suppose the real question is, all right, first of all, we have all of these exercises and drills and other things going on, which completely depleted the Eastern Seaboard of its air defenses to the point where they were sending aircraft out to the West Coast to respond to a Russian war game that was taking place at that time, and all sorts of things that just left it so that there was only a few planes left and they weren't ready and they couldn't respond in time. Who would have been able to know that September 11th, 2001 was an actually uniquely situated day in the calendar of potentially the entire history of the United States? Certainly at that time, it was the perfect day to try some sort of air attack because of the depleted defenses on the Eastern Seaboard there generally. Would Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda members have known about that? Or would that be the type of information that would be known to people in NORAD and NATO and the upper echelons of the White House, etc.? Again, something to think about. Obviously not conclusive, but the fact that these exercises were going on, including, I hope infamously, maybe the general public still doesn't know about it, including the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, running a drill of a hijacked jet crashing into one of its own buildings on September 11th, 2001. So they were evacuating the building while, oh, planes are crashing into buildings here. So again, there's so many instances of that it does seem to amount to something. Any particular instance will just seem as, oh, that's just some sort of coincidence. But put together and put in a larger context, it certainly seems that either the terrorists were the luckiest individuals in the history of attacking the United States, or there was some level of coordination with regards to the timing of these attacks.
Yeah, just on the war games, I think it was Vanity Fair who got hold of all the NORAD tapes, and you had someone on there literally on the recording going, are we still in a simulation or is this real life? Like, clearly confused, and they go, real life. Like, he's still not really sure what's a war game, what's not. You also had other people doing war games where they was asked to carry on for another half an hour. They're like, should we stop? And they're like, no. And then half an hour stopped. It's worth listening to those. I will try and clip them up in the post-editing process of this, as I think.
Part 4. This is not an exercise.
11, you hear Boston Center?
Hi, Boston Center TMU. We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York, and we need you guys to, we need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there to help us out.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise manifest.
Confusion.
Okay,
Now we do. This is what I got.
You hear about that input booth?
Possible news that 737 just hit the World Trade Center. This is a real world. And we're trying to confirm this.
Okay.
Continue taking the fighters down to the New York City area, JFK area, as best as you can. Make sure that the FAA clears your route all the way through. Just do what we got to do. Okay? Just press with us. It looks like somebody... It looks like this guy could have hit the World Trade Center.
Chaos.
Do we want to think about scrambling aircraft?
Oh, God, I don't know.
That's a decision somebody's going to have to make probably in the next 10 minutes.
Everybody just left the room.
Paralysis. There are many ways to describe the FAA, DOD, and NORAD response to the events of 9/11. But given that, according to the official 9/11 conspiracy theory, not a single fighter jet was able to intercept a single hijacked airliner between the first hijacking report at 8:20 a.m. and Flight 93's downing nearly 2 hours later at 10:03 a.m., the claim that the response to these events was actually enhanced by the war games and exercises taking place that morning is downright absurd.
The question was, we had four war games going on September 11th, and the question that I tried to pose before the secretary had to go to lunch was whether or not the activities of the four war games going on September 11th actually impaired our ability to respond to the attacks.
The answer to the question is no, did not impair our response. In fact, General Eberhardt, who was then the commander of North American Aerospace Defense Command, as he testified in front of the 9/11 Commission, I believe he told them that it enhanced our ability to respond, given that NORAD didn't have the overall responsibility for responding to the attacks today. That was an FAA responsibility.
A question about our training posture on the day of 9/11. On page 5 of our staff statement, the FAA says at 8:38 in the morning, "Hi, Boston Center, TMU, we have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York, and we need you guys to, we need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there. Help us out." NEAD says, "Is this real world or an exercise?" My question is, you were postured for an exercise against the former Soviet Union. Did that help or hurt? Did that help in terms of were more people prepared? Did you have more people ready? Were more fighters fueled with more fuel? Or did this hurt in terms of people thinking, no, there's no possibility that this is real world? We're engaged in an exercise and delay things. Or did it have both impacts?
Sir, my belief is that it helped. Because of the manning, because of the focus, because the crews, they have to be airborne in 15 minutes, and that morning, because of the exercise, they were airborne in 6 or 8 minutes. And so I believe that focus helped. The situation that you're referring to, I think at most cost us 30 seconds.
These lies have been carefully crafted over years and presented in such densely packed sound bites that it is difficult to deconstruct them all. General Myers' assertion that it was not NORAD, but the FAA that had the responsibility to respond to the attacks that morning is one such lie. In reality, NORAD is specifically tasked with dealing with such events itself, not waiting passively for FAA orders. NORAD's own regulations for dealing with hijacked jets specifically state that FAA authorization for interceptor operations is not used for intercept and airborne surveillance of hijacked aircraft within the continental United States. And General Eberhardt's assertion that the confusion over whether the events that were unfolding were real-world events or merely exercises cost us 30 seconds is belied by the actual audio recordings of the FAA and NORAD response that morning. Time and time again throughout the entire morning, air traffic controllers and military operators are forced to clarify that the events being reported are not part of an exercise.
Hi, Boston Center, TMU. We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York, and we need you guys to
We need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there to help us out.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise, not a test.
What?
Whoa.
What was that?
Not real world. Real world magic.
Cool.
Real?
1443, look for it, right there. Okay, mode 3, 1443, last known. No, this is real world. Okay, run the high check.
Hey, I've never seen so much real world stuff happen during an exercise.
I think we put the exercise on the hold, what do you think?
pretty vital to hear. Again, whether you want to go down, this was a government source handing this information over to do it on this day, or whether it was just, again, complete lies. You know, like you said, they said this actually made it easier. It's obviously complete garbage. You didn't actually say your view earlier, but I'll actually leave that to the end, because maybe after everything
right,
we've discussed.
I should, while we're on that note, though, of the fake injects on the radar blip, as I said, the official story is they realized the real world event was happening, so they cleared them. But that doesn't explain the Phantom Flight 11, which was, I can't remember if it hit the South or North Tower, but at any rate, for some reason, apparently, NORAD was tracking Flight 11 after it had crashed, and was apparently heading towards Washington. And that seems, it's difficult to tell from the absolute mess of confusion that was happening that day, but they were tracking some sort of phantom blip for some period of time, some valuable minutes after that point, where supposedly it had already crashed. So what were they tracking? How did that work? What was the real state of the radar system? What interjects, what imaginary hallucinatory injects remained in the systems after the point at which they were supposedly cleared? I think there's still a lot more interesting questions that people can ask about that.
Yeah, and again, I won't make you go into too much detail on Tower 7, but I think that's the one that has kind of, over the years, and changed people's minds. Because, I mean, you have a video of Donald Rumsfeld in 2007 or something where he's asked about Tower 7. He's like, I've never heard of it. Never heard of it. Like, there's literally videos of Tower 7 which didn't get hit, which goes down like a controlled demolition because apparently the jet fuel melted the steel structure and made it collapse like that. He's asked about it. I'm not sure if it was We Are Change or something like that. And he says, oh, no, never heard of Tower 7. No, I didn't know about that. Like, just complete lie. But, you know, why would you even say that? You know, why would you even say that? But, you know, you've had over the years loads of engineers and structural architects come out and say that was, you know, a complete garbage story. It's never happened.
Some important things to note about Tower 7, one of which is that NIST itself was forced, after forwarding and retracting five separate explanations for why World Trade Center 7 collapsed. It took them 7 years to come out with their actual final report on Building 7 because it was such an abnormality. They eventually decided it was because of a failure of a certain column at a certain point because of heat stress from fire. And that was what they went with. But in fact, the building did collapse at 3 seconds of its descent, which is, in human terms, non-engineering terms, a free-fall gravitational descent can only happen uniform across the face of a building if every single structural connection underneath that point was all severed at the same moment. This is not a collapse of a failure of a certain column at a certain point that kind of brings the building down in a haphazard, crumbling fashion like we might expect from an actual collapse. This is literally a top-down descent, its own footprint, at free-fall gravitational acceleration. If you dropped a ball off of the roof, it would have fallen at the same rate of the roof, at least for a portion of that building's descent. That's, again, that is not explicable from the explanation that NIST gave. And it, as you say, there have been many engineers who have talked about it. There was, in fact, an extensive study that was released by Professor Halsey at the University of Alaska Fairbanks just a few years ago that concluded, yes, this was not the result of a spontaneous fire-induced collapse. This was some sort of explosive event. So anyway, there is a lot of meat on those bones for people who are just finding out about Building 7.
Just on the Twin Towers, I mean, Jason Burmes did a couple of documentaries, Loose Change, Fabled Enemies. What do you make of the people at the Twin Towers saying they heard explosions in the basements. And, you know, everyone always goes, well, you know, they was there. There's a lot going on. That didn't happen. You know, they just heard it. What do you make of the various witnesses in the buildings saying they heard explosions? Again, I know it's only speculation.
Once again, for people who think that this is just some sort of rumor or is it just gossip or what, how could you possibly quantify it? There have been scientific papers written about this. For example, the late, great Professor Gray McQueen wrote a paper for the Journal of 9/11 Studies about the eyewitnesses to the explosive event at World Trade Center, in which he documented, he went through all of the oral testimonies of the firefighters and first responders and policemen that were in the wake of those attacks. Scripts were eventually used, and all of them, literally every one of them, and noted the number of times that witnesses talked about something relating to an explosion, explosive sound, that sort of phenomenon. And so he's detailed it there. This is not just some random thing that someone, some rumor that someone talked about. This is something that was mentioned over and over and over and over again in the witness testimony. Definitely explosions that were taking place. The only question is, well, then what caused those explosions? And there are a number of, within the official story, there are a number of explanations that can be given to try to poo-poo that testimony. For example, I've talked, for example, about William Rodriguez, who was a janitor at the World Trade Center, who ultimately was hailed as a hero. He had a key that was able to open stairwells and get access to people who were trying to escape the building, and he managed to personally save numerous people that day, pulling them out before the buildings, I was going to say, collapsed. That, I think, is not the right way of framing it, but anyway, you understand what I mean. Having said that, William Rodriguez testified that he experienced an explosive event that took place at least 1 to 2 seconds before the impact of the airplane. And people can listen to his testimony about that. But he was in the basement at the time, and there was an explosive event in the basement. And somebody came out of the, I believe it was the elevator or the stairwell at that point, skin hanging off of them, completely covered in blood, obviously had been the victim of some sort of explosive event. At some point, 1 to 2 seconds after the explosive event occurred, there was the thud that was the explosion or the impact from the plane. So his testimony, for example, would say that would go against what has been proffered by the defenders of the official story. No, when the plane hit the building, obviously the fuel dumped out. It was on fire. It went down the elevator shafts, which caused an explosive event, which you can see demonstrably in the videos of the lobby. Again, I can't remember South Tower now, North Tower, but there are videos of when they were originally staging in the lobby and the glass has been blown out. There's clearly been an explosive event that's taken place in the lobby. What was that? Oh, well, they say, oh, it was the fuel coming down the elevator shafts that blew it out. William Rodriguez says, no, absolutely not. An explosive event took place before the impact of the airplane. Again, that's just one example from many, 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 many that could be cited. But yes, clearly there were explosive events taking place. The only question is what caused them and what ultimately resulted from them. And as I just talked about on New World Next Week just a few weeks ago, yet more new footage has emerged of somebody who, for whatever reason, had kept their footage of the demolition of the towers for 23 years and finally decided to release it on the internet. And I would say it provides a different perspective than the one that we're seeing. I can't remember, again, from which vantage point it was filmed, but a different one than the ones that most of the footage that we've seen of those buildings was filmed. And the only thing that I got out of it that was really hit home again was clearly the initiation of the so-called collapse. There's clearly an explosive event that's taking place underneath that point of impact. And again, what does that mean? Does that mean that somehow the fire that was raging, or was it really raging? Because again, we also have firefighter transmissions. We can knock this fire down with two lines, was one of the final transmissions of one of the people to actually reach the point of impact. But at any rate, supposedly the fire was raging so intensely that it basically softened the steel to the point where it ended up in this the collapse, which Interestingly enough, in this eventual final report that they released on the trade, the Twin Towers destruction, they said they brought it up to that point. They said, well, it must have been reaching temperatures of so-and-so, and this caused the steel to give way. And then total collapse initiated. And that is literally their explanation for what we see of these thousands and thousands and thousands of tons of structural steel, not just collapsing, not falling, obliterating floor by floor down to the ground level, top down, straight down. Again, it's one of those things that I watched, as I say, that was emblazoned in my mind as one of those images that we saw hundreds, maybe thousands of times in the weeks and months after 9/11. And yet I never really saw it until the first time I really started to question what was happening there. Is this a building collapsing? Or is this a building that is exploding, pulverizing into dust as it is going down? And ultimately, I have arrived at the latter conclusion, which obviously creates significant problems for the official story.
Yeah, so you obviously did the War Games documentary. You've done other ones. So I'm going to, I guess, hand over to you what way you want to move with the conversation. So you've done documentaries on Trillions, you've done it on Suspects, you've done it on the Whistleblowers, you've done the recent series on Al-Qaeda and lots of other things. You know, is there, what's, you know, we've discussed the War Games, what evidence do you feel, because a lot of it is speculation after all, because of the type of event it is, but what do you feel, not necessarily the smoking gun, is it a collection of evidence, all these inconsistencies? Again, at the end I'll get your actual view of what you think happened, who maybe was involved, but what evidence do you want to put forward, I guess, to the audience to you know, either just make them think about it or change their mind, or just have something to look into? What do you think is the evidence that points more towards something fishy going on?
Well, thank you for framing it that way, because there is a lot of evidence. And do I have a sealed, signed, delivered document from Dick Cheney saying bring the towers down? Of course not. But there is a lot of evidence on so many different lines of investigation, and it has always been a part of the consternation that I have about the way that 9/11 Truth developed, that it became 100% totally, solely, and completely focused on the destruction of the buildings, to the exclusion of absolutely every other examination of the event, which is why I don't have big, long documentaries about the destruction of the towers. As I say, I certainly don't believe that they collapsed spontaneously or due to fires, but I do not concentrate my research firepower on that, because everyone, I mean literally everyone else who talks about 9/11 Truth talks about that. So I'll talk about literally every other aspect of the investigation, and there are many, many fruitful lines of investigation for people to follow. As you mentioned, 9/11 Trillions, I did an entire documentary about various aspects of the money trail of 9/11, because it is as true today as it was back during Watergate when they first started using this phrase, follow the money, right? You have to follow the money in a criminal investigation to see where things are going. And in this case, there are many different ways that you can follow the money. One of the most straightforward, one of the most absolutely direct lines of evidence that you could get is, was there informed trading before the attacks took place? And the answer to that is an unqualified yes. And I'm not saying that speculatively. I'm saying that definitively. There has been not one, not two, but three separate scientific studies published in peer-reviewed economic journals concluding that all of the evidence shows that, yes, all of the evidence is that there was informed trading, or is at the very least, in the weaselly language of the conclusion of one of the papers, the evidence is consistent with the idea that there was informed trading of the attack taking place before 9/11. And of course, I think everyone has at least heard of the put options on American Airlines, United Airlines, that took place in the week or so leading up to the attacks, the couple of weeks leading up to the attacks. And for people who don't know, put options, basically the idea that you're going to buy a stock at a certain level, and if you'll be able to sell that stock, you'll be able to buy that stock at a certain level later. No, you'll be able to sell that stock at a certain level later on. There we go. At which point, so basically you're betting that the stock is going to plummet. You're going to be able to sell it at that price that you locked in at, so you're going to be able to realize those gains, right? You can buy it at the cheaper level and sell it at the higher level. It's a bet, right? And of course, there's the opposite of puts. There are
calls, which is the exact opposite. So in that case, you can buy it at the lower level and sell it at the higher level. Whatever, you get the idea. And so everyone has heard about the put options on United and American, which, of course, the airline stock plummeted in the wake of 9/11. And people have heard about that investigation because it was talked about, for example, on ABC News. I have a clip in 9/11 Trillions of one of the investigative reporters who was working on that at that time, talking about that particular trail and the fact that it was being investigated quite seriously by the Securities and Exchange Commission and investigators from multiple countries, Germany, Japan, Switzerland. There were investigations that were happening around the world into those trades because it wasn't just put options on United and American. It was put options on a number of important clients in the World Trade Center itself, Marsh & McLennan and other large investment firms and other insurance agents and people that worked in the World Trade Center. And it was also call options on stocks that went up in the wake of 9/11. For example, Raytheon and other military contractors who, of course, saw a gigantic boon with the dawn of the war.
On September 12, 2001, before the dust had even settled on Ground Zero, the Securities and Exchange Commission opened an investigation into a chilling proposition that an unknown group of traders with advanced knowledge of the 9/11 plot had made millions betting against the companies involved in the attacks.
What many Wall Street analysts believe is that the terrorists made bets that a number of stocks would see their prices fall. They did so by buying what are called puts. If you bet right, the rewards can be huge. The risks are also huge, unless, of course, you know something bad is going to happen to the company you're betting against.
This could very well be insider trading at the worst, most horrific, most evil use you've ever seen in your entire life.
One example, United Airlines. The Thursday before the attack, more than 2,000 contracts betting that the stock would go down were purchased, 90 times more in one day than in 3 weeks. When the markets reopened, United's stock dropped. The price of the contracts soared, and someone may have made a lot of money fast.
$180,000 turns into $2.4 million when that plane hits the World Trade Center.
It's almost the same story with American Airlines.
That's a five-fold increase in the value of what was a $337,000 trade on Monday.
All of a sudden becomes what?
$1.8 million.
And there's much more, including an extraordinarily high number of bets against Morgan Stanley and Marsh & McLennan, two of the World Trade Center's biggest tenants.
Could this be a coincidence? This would be one of the most extraordinary coincidences in the history of mankind if it was a coincidence.
Although the put options on American and United Airlines are usually cited in reference to the 9/11 insider trading, these trades only represent a fraction of the suspicious trades leading up to the attack. Between August 20th and September 10th, abnormally large spikes in put option activity appeared in trades involving dozens of different companies whose stocks plunged after the attack, including Boeing, Merrill Lynch, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, Munich Re, and the AXA Group. Traders weren't just betting against the companies whose stocks dove after 9/11, however. There was also a six-fold increase in call options on the stock of defense contractor Raytheon on the day before 9/11. The options allowed the traders to buy Raytheon stock at $25. Within a week of the attack, as the American military began deploying the Raytheon-supplied Tomahawk missiles they would eventually use in the invasion of Afghanistan, the company's share price had shot up 37% to over $34. The SEC weren't the only ones interested in this particular 9/11 money trail either. Investigations into potential insider trading before the attacks were opened by authorities around the globe, from Belgium to France to Germany to Switzerland to Japan. It wasn't long before this global financial manhunt started yielding clues on the trail of the terror traders. On September 17th, Italian Foreign Minister Antonio Martino, addressing Italian CONSOB's own investigation into potential 9/11 trading, said, "I think there are terrorist states and organizations behind speculation on the international markets." By September 24th, the Belgian finance minister was confident enough to publicly announce Belgium's strong suspicions that British markets may have been used for transactions. The president of Germany's central bank was the most adamant. "What we found makes us sure that people connected to the terrorists must have been trying to profit from this tragedy." These foreign leaders were not alone in their conviction that insider trading had taken place. University of Chicago finance professor George Constantinides, Columbia University law professor John Coffey, Duke University law professor James Cox, and other academics, as well as well-known options traders like John Najarian, all expressed their belief that investors had traded on advanced knowledge of the attacks. The scale of the SEC investigation was unprecedented, examining over 9.5 million securities transactions, including stocks and options in 103 different companies trading in 7 markets, 32 exchange-traded funds, and stock indices. The probe drew on the assistance of the legal and compliance staff of the 20 largest trading firms and the regulatory authorities in 10 foreign governments. The commission coordinated its investigation with the FBI, the Department of Justice, and the Department of the Treasury. The results of this investigation? We have not developed any evidence suggesting that those who had advanced knowledge of the September 11th attacks traded on the basis of that information. Although this sounds like the investigation did not find evidence of insider trading, a second look reveals the trick. They are not saying that there was no insider trading, only that there is no evidence that those who had advanced knowledge of the September 11th attacks participated in such trading. But this begs the question, who had that advanced knowledge, and how did the SEC determine this? The 9/11 Commission report begs the question even more blatantly in their treatment of the anomalous put option activity on United Airlines stock on September 6th. 95% of the puts were placed by a single U.S.-based institutional investor with no conceivable ties to Al-Qaeda. Again, it is taken as a foregone conclusion that a lack of ties to Al-Qaeda means there could not have been advance knowledge of the attack, even if the evidence shows that insider trading took place. To be sure, insider trading almost certainly did take place in the weeks before 9/11. Although some have used the commission report to conclude that the story was debunked, the intervening years have seen the release of not one, not two, but three separate scientific papers concluding with high probability that the anomalous trading was the result of advanced knowledge.
On terror, because as the lone gunman, TV pilot, put it, just, what, 6 months before the events took place, if we go into, if there was a 727 loaded with passengers, as the, one of the characters in that pilot said, that went down in New York, you would find no end of tin pot dictators just begging to be smart bombed, because this is the end of the Cold War. We need more markets for our arms and manufacturers. Anyway, regardless of that crazy sci-fi nonsense that was aired on TV, that is exactly what happened in reality. Raytheon and the other military contractors went up in value. And yes, you better believe, just as there were put options against United and American and some of the other tenants of the World Trade Center, there were call options on various military contractors. And all of these added up to an unusual, a documentably, quantifiably unusual level of trading activity leading up to 9/11 that, as three separate papers found, was consistent with the idea that there was informed trading of the attacks. And the interesting part of this, well, there's a lot of interesting parts of that story, including the fact that some of these extremely unusual orders were being brokered by Alex Brown, which is a brokerage that until 1998 was being helmed by Buzzy Krongard, who went on to become the executive director of the CIA, the third man in charge, essentially the third person in line at the CIA on the day of 9/11. Just another one of those interesting coincidences that occurs. But in the follow-up subsequent investigation, ultimately, of course, as I read here, well, we determined that those trades hadn't went back to investors that had no conceivable ties to Al-Qaeda and therefore had no relation to the 9/11 attacks. Wait, what? What is begging the question again? Anyway, as Kevin Ryan discovered in his research, he dug up the actual records of the interviews and the reports that they were filing on that investigation, and he found that the people that went back to included such people as Wirt D. Walker III, a distant relative of the Bush family, and also a business partner with Marvin Bush in Stratesec, which was itself implicated in the events of 9/11. But some of these trades, 56,000 shares of Stratesec, et cetera, went back to Wirt D. Walker III, but they dismissed it because he has no conceivable ties to Al-Qaeda, so he couldn't have possibly known about attacks beforehand, right? It's that type of interesting non-investigation that comes up time and again. And guess what? The SEC eventually ended up shredding the entire record of their entire investigation, which at that time was the largest investigation in SEC history. That's routine record keeping. They just destroyed all of the documents, everything related to it. In fact, there was a CBOE, Chicago Board of Exchange researcher, whistleblower, who anonymously talked in 2006 about the fact to the Business Policy Journal, I believe, Foreign Policy, I can't remember the name of the journal, but he talked that they were destroying records at that time. They were destroying records of this ongoing investigation that you would think people might want to get to the bottom of, but apparently someone did not. Anyway, I think that's one example of, there's lots of rumors and sort of things that float around. No, this is a real thing that really happened. We have lots of different ways into this story, and we can demonstrably prove, yes, unusual spike in trading activity that was consistent with evidence pointing to informed trading on the attacks, but it doesn't relate to Al-Qaeda, which might relate to, say, CIA, ex-CIA Robert Baer's ridiculous, weird statement about, oh, I knew the guy whose brother worked in the White House, and he cashed out the day before 9/11 saying it's all going down.
Crash into their building, and you know they're staffed by DOD and
CIA, right? I know the guy that went into his broker in San Diego and said, cash me out, it's going down tomorrow.
Really?
Yeah.
That tells us something.
What?
That tells us something.
Well, his brother worked in the White House.
And when you say that there's...
down. As he just said at the end of a spontaneous street interview with some street activists, and he says this and walks away. If anybody said that, well, whatever, who's this guy? But no, this is Robert Baer, a.k.a. you know, George Clooney from Syriana, the famed CIA operative, who just casually says that, walks away, never gets questioned about it again for the rest of his life. Who cares? Whatever. Oh, he knows the guy whose brother cashed out the day before 9/11? Whatever. He had no conceivable ties to Al-Qaeda, so what does it matter? These are examples of the money trail and the way it leads. Although everyone, of course, by this point, I would sincerely hope everyone has heard about the missing $2.3 trillion that was not, to be fair, sometimes it said it was announced the day before 9/11. It was known. It was a known issue that even Rumsfeld talked about in his Senate confirmation hearings when he was coming in the door in January of 2001. It was a known issue that existed. But it was on September 10th, 2001, that Donald Rumsfeld took the initiative to hold a press conference at the Pentagon to announce and declare a new war, a war on bureaucracy, because it turns out we just can't keep track of all these trillions of dollars in transactions. And I don't know, trillions of dollars seems to be missing behind some couch cushions. Who can tell? The next day, 9/11 happens. And for some reason, what would have been probably the biggest financial scandal in the history of the United States becomes a footnote. Who even remembers it? Well, only 9/11 truthers seem to remember that sort of remarkable moment. So yes, there's a lot to talk about other than simply the way the buildings exploded. And eventually that leads us to my False Flags documentary, the by far the biggest documentary I've ever done, a 3-part, 5.5-hour exploration of Al-Qaeda. And what is this group? Where did it come from? Who was populating the ranks of this organization? Was it even really an actual organization, or was it essentially a creation of a New York courtroom from a Manhattan trial in 2001? What is Al-Qaeda, and what does it really mean, and who is behind it? That's a story that takes a few hours to tell in a competent way, at any rate, and there's a lot to say about it. But I think that's another incredibly important part of this story, because clearly, if myself and others are saying this official story is not true and they are not telling you what really happened that day, and there is active evidence of complicity at all sorts of levels within the military establishment, within the White House, within the intelligence agencies, well, what about Al-Qaeda? What is Al-Qaeda, and how were they involved with this, and what does this mean? Who is Osama bin Laden? Those seem like questions that that permit of at least being asked, let alone answered.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'd recommend people to go to that documentary, and they probably don't have enough time to lay that out. So if you'd be willing to come on, you know, some point in the future, I'd love to, to chat through with that and just make it specifically about that. As you said, it's about 5.5 hours, maybe 6 hours long, 3-part documentary. Just, I guess, to stay on track where we was. So for people who are wondering, you know, there's the obvious gains from using 9/11 to do obviously the whole war on terror Afghanistan, Iraq, which, as you said, both of these events are happening before the commission, the 9/11 commission's even done their report yet. It's not even finished, and they've already gone into two countries and declared a war on terror and, and decided everything that's happened. Saddam Hussein, you know, yeah, always implying, talking about him in the same sentence as 9/11 without really saying how he was involved, just making that connection in your brain so people go, yeah, Iraq, 9/11, yeah, it must be that, it must be related. So there's the obvious games there. But when most people go, you know, who did 9/11, people go like George Bush, Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, but it's probably not really quite like that. So what do you think the main kind of suspects are? I know you've done a documentary on that. Who would have been involved in this? And, you know, what are the countries involved? You know, Saudi Arabia always gets brought up. Israel's name gets dropped in. And then we can get to your overall view of what you feel happened that day, as much as you can speculate based off the evidence you've seen. So, you know, who are the main suspects and who allowed this to happen or engineered it or, you know, whatever?
Well, there are many people that we can and should be looking at. I would say if you want to look at an operational level, who would have, if this was truly, actually, in reality, really an inside job, who would we be looking at as, say, a first order of someone that we could bring to trial and really start opening this can of worms and finding out the operational details? I would think it would go probably to Dick Cheney as probably the first person you'd really want to actually put under oath. And I'm going to have to check to make sure, but I'm constantly checking and constantly amazed that he is still alive and his robotic heart is still beating. At any rate, there's no justice in the world, apparently. But no, I think Dick Cheney, seriously, would be someone that you would want to be actively investigating. And this is something that's been long recognized. One of the original first people questioning the events of 9/11 and the immediate aftermath, Michael Rupert, wrote Crossing the Rubicon, did some of the initial research into this. And it was his contention that this was essentially run, this was an operation that was being run by Dick Cheney. And he had reasons for believing that. I think that that's not quite the way that I would envision that, and I think a lot more information has come out since then. But he did raise some interesting points about Dick Cheney taking over various emergency powers within the White House, and also the fact that Cheney and Rumsfeld had been the two people back in the 70s under the Ford administration initially working on continuity of government plans that were enacted on 9/11/2001. So they clearly have some bearing on the events of 9/11, at least in that fashion. So Cheney and Rumsfeld would definitely be two people you'd want to be looking into. One of the fascinating aspects of 9/11, that's just one of this incredible rabbit hole that doesn't get enough attention, that I've talked about before, is P-TECH, which was this enterprise architecture software firm that was running this at the time, back in 2000 or so, this incredibly futuristic technology. It would be able to look through absolutely every system, every database that's running within an overall architecture of a large-scale organization, like, say, the Department of Defense or what have you, and be able to not only see what was happening in every part, but ultimately to predict events and to essentially warn you about things that are coming. And we know about this because there was a whistleblower named Indira Singh, who at the time was working for J.P. Morgan and was doing due diligence on this software. Does she want to use this for J.P. Morgan? Because obviously a vast, sprawling banking enterprise like that needs to know about things like insider trading and weird things that are happening in various parts of their vast enterprise. They need to be able to look at that and secure funds, etc. And there are billions upon billions of dollars on the line. So they take that very seriously. So she was looking at this. This is a cutting edge group that clearly they were working with the Department of Defense and the FAA and the IRS and all of this laundry list of government organizations, corporate tie-ins. So they've clearly been vetted and approved by many different people. She was looking into it, and she started to find some really weird things about that group and the people who were behind it and the angel investor who was one of the people who helped to form the group that became P-TECH. And he turned out to be someone that eventually the Department of Treasury put on their terrorist warning list as an associate of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. He was on a European terror list, etc. And he was funding this group that was working with the U.S. government on backdoors to all of its computer systems. Like, what is going on here? But don't worry, guys. He got taken off the terrorist list a decade and a half later. So all's well that ends well. There's so much more to that story. But the long story short of it, Michael Rupert was particularly interested because it was Indira Singh's, well, one of the things that she was able to provide with the documentation of what she was talking about was the fact that the FAA and the Department of Defense were working on interoperability, compatibility issues between their systems. They were working on that on 9/11 in the Pentagon. And who was working on that? Well, PTEC was facilitating that. And it was Indira Singh's insinuation, Michael Rupert's ultimate belief that it was Dick Cheney that was in the PEOC, the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, with access to PTEC that was helping to do things like inserting a Phantom Flight 11. Again, this is speculative, obviously. This is speculative. But it is certainly a line of investigation that seems fruitful. And even if it doesn't go to Dick Cheney particularly, I think that there are clearly people in these organizations that would, should be brought under oath in an actual court of law under a real, true justice tribunal trial that would actually be looking into these events. Unfortunately, nothing of that sort has taken place in the 23 years since the events took place.
Yeah, because Dick Cheney and George Bush basically went into a closed room just between themselves, you know, rather than separating them to tell to testify their story. Just to finish up then, can you just give people your general view of what you think happened? Do you think it was straight up full inside job, as in it was engineered? Was it facilitated in this attack was already maybe going to take place? What is your view of what happened on that day?
Yeah, disclaimer, this is speculation from someone who does not know. I was not there. I was not involved in the planning of 9/11, so I do not know. And I don't have access to subpoena, and I can't get people under oath, and I can't start looking into documents, financial documents, and getting that myself, etc. So take it for what it's worth, which is probably not that much. But from the decades now that I've spent researching this, yes, I do believe this was an inside job. I believe this was not simply allowed to happen. I believe that it was facilitated. And I use lines of evidence like the war games, like the financial trail. And also, I mean, for example, just as one example from the False Flags documentary, I believe there was terrorists that believed themselves to be working with the organization that we know of as Al-Qaeda, that were being run as part of a plot that did involve essentially the cover story for what eventually took place on 9/11. I am particularly persuaded by, but obviously, again, this is speculative, and I don't think I'm not definitive about this, but I am persuaded by the arguments of Aidan Monahan and other researchers like that about the almost impossible banking turns that the planes took, which indicate that there was remote control activity going on those planes, that they were being remote controlled. I think that's probably most likely, but again, it's speculative. I'm not dying on that hill, which of course would indicate, well, okay, maybe there were hijackers on those planes, but they probably weren't controlling them, which again lines up with the other lines of evidence, like Hani Hanjour, who could not pilot a small Cessna, who was literally kicked out of flying school after flying school for being an absolutely terribly lousy pilot, who, of course, took the helm of Flight 77 and did this corkscrew amazing 8,000-foot descending turn to come down exactly level with the ground at the Pentagon to hit exactly the exact part of the Pentagon that was working on the missing $2.3 trillion, or at least part of that? Wow, what a coincidence. Anyway, again, there's a lot to go into with all of that. But so, yes, there were these operatives, but who were they really? And as I touched on in the False Flags documentary, clearly these cocaine-snorting, alcohol-drinking, stripper-cavorting Muslim terrorists who were doing it for the greater glory of Allah? Or were they actually, as has been alleged by Venice Flying Circus, I can't remember his name right off the top of my head, I believe he passed away recently, researcher who did books and documentaries about that, he thought they were part of a drug running operation that was being handled by various parts of the U.S. military and intelligence complex. And there's a whole Rudy Deckers and the Venice flight school and all. I mean, I have 8,000 hours of information that I could download if I could just simply download it from my head. Anyway, there's so much more to say about various aspects of this, but I believe there were essentially patsies that were being maneuvered into place. And that's not insignificant because it leads to things like, for example, Donald Canestrero, who is the one of the investigators for the military commission that's happening in Guantanamo Bay, who a few years ago managed to come out with this 20-plus page document of research that he'd done, which confirmed and doubled down on what Richard Clark had told Duffy and Novoselsky. I'm pointing at my bookshelf, as if you can see the book on the shelf. A couple of researchers, interviewers, independent people who made 9/11 Press for Truth and other documentaries like that, they managed to secure an interview with Richard Clark back in 2011, where he casually told them, oh, yeah, I think that Al-Hazmi and Al-Maidar, two of the alleged hijackers who the CIA lost on their way into the United States, and then, oh, just discovered like a week before, 2 weeks before 9/11, and they didn't have time to round them up. He said, I think this was essentially the CIA knew they were there, they were trying to run them, and it blew up in their face. And he doubled down in that Canestrero document and said, yes, I believe this, that was a false flag operation. He said, his words, false flag operation being run by the CIA through their Saudi cutouts, through Omar Bayoumi in Los Angeles, running Al-Hazmi and Al-Maidar, trying to get these two Al-Qaeda operatives to work as double agents, but it didn't work out and they ended up slipping away and causing 9/11. So anyway, there's aspects of that that even if people don't want to go full on total inside job, at the very least, when you have the former counterterror czar of the Clinton and Bush era talking about, yeah, I think it was a false flag operation that the CIA were running with these two alleged terrorists. That seems like, I don't know, something that literally any news broadcast in the world should maybe mention once in a while. But no. Crickets, total silence. Who cares? Whatever. Whatever. False flag. Who cares? Anyway, that's just a tiny sliver into the bigger window. There was clearly intelligence trickery and shenanigans going on 7 ways from Sunday surrounding that entire operation. And for someone like me, just a regular old guy in Japan, to come along and say, yes, I know exactly what happened and I'm going to explain every aspect of this operation. No, probably not. But at the very, very, very least, I have my head screwed on straight. I have read an awful lot about this. In fact, just parenthetically, that Canestrero document of 20 plus pages, I remember reading it and going through, prepared to highlight literally any scrap of information that I didn't already know. There wasn't a single one. Every single thing that he said, even the redacted names. I'm like, oh, I know who that is because I read that book. Oh, I know who that is because I've heard that interview, et cetera, et cetera. There was literally no new information in there. So I've read a lot. I've studied a lot. I've researched a lot. And I know enough to know that I don't know what actually happened on 9/11. But I absolutely know this is a tissue of lies constructed from torture testimony that should not be believed by anybody. And we will never have truth and justice for 9/11 as long as this is still held up as the holy Bible of that day.
Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that you just think there's too many inconsistencies for it to be blowback. You know, they were still trying to use these terrorists like they did in the 80s against the Soviets, or in the 90s in Eastern Europe where they still used them, Al-Qaeda in Bosnia and other places. You just think there's too many. I know I'm not going to make you give a long answer, but you just think there's no way it could have been blowback. The reason these visas were, they was allowing these clearly suspicious people in wasn't due to other activities or other ideas. There's no way it was just blowback.
No, blowback is a fallback of the official story that's embedded in there as one of the narratives that can be used to essentially bolster that same story. And I say that advisedly. There was active and I can't stress this enough, active complicity of the CIA in covering up various aspects of what they knew. So even if we were to believe these were genuine, authentic terrorists, they were aiding those terrorists, demonstrably so. And we have multiple lines of evidence from that. Once you have finished watching False Flags, the full documentary, yes, let's continue this conversation because there is so much more to say about that blowback hypothesis, which is nothing other than a cowardly attempt to bolster a narrative that absolutely does not fit.
Yeah, no, that's a great place to leave it. I do need to finish that whole documentary. Love to have you on again. Just like to thank you for coming on. Always nice to chat. You're always I like your honesty that you don't pretend that you know everything, that every 9/11 bit means this is the smoking gun, it must be this. You come across quite well. So I think if you are on the fence, people watching, just go to the documentaries you've watched, make it your mind for yourself. You don't have to, again, I don't have a consolidated view yet because I feel I still need to properly get my hands on some more books and things like that until I make a view. But I'm definitely suspicious, open to information. And there is still stuff coming. I can't remember what it was, but it was a recent court document came out about a CIA link to a Saudi intelligence person who was bringing a couple of the people involved over in the country. I can't remember that. I'll put it up.
Ayumi and Al-Hazmi and Al-Maidar. Yes, we will get into that next time for sure.
Sure, but appreciate you need to jump off. But thanks again for your time. And if everyone watching, just, yeah, check out all the links and the documentaries that I put up as a, you could maybe change your mind. But yeah, thanks again and have a nice rest of the day, James.
Thank you.
Thanks.
If some terrorist group wants to act out this scenario, why target you for assassination?
Depends on who your terrorists are.
The men who conceived of it in the first place. You're saying our government plans to commit a terrorist act against a domestic airline?
There you go. Indicting the entire government as usual. It's a faction. A small faction.
For what possible gain?
The Cold War's over, John. But with no clear enemy to stockpile against, the arms market's flat. But bring down a fully loaded 727 into the middle of New York City, and you'll find a dozen tin pot dictators all over the world just clamoring to take responsibility and begging to be smart bombed.